Support for the World's Podcast comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ, or Curious Quotient, through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/the world.
Equal work, unequal pay, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. America's top female soccer players are suing for the right to get paid as much as the men.
It doesn't matter if you're a woman or it doesn't matter if you're a man. If those people are watching and those people are coming to games, then you should be paid the same amount of money.
Also, Donald Trump's flip-flop on abortion has everyone talking. We hear from El Salvador, where women are prosecuted if they're caught terminating a pregnancy.
What is happening is there has been a spike on illegal abortion.
Plus, a decade ago, thousands marched for immigration reform. Now some of those marchers want to take the next step.
In the rallies back in 06, there were a lot of signs that said, hoy marchamos, mañana votamos. Today we march, tomorrow we vote.
Those stories and more today on The World. Glad you could be here. He said it, and then he tried to unsay it. But Donald Trump's comments about punishing women who have abortions are out there, no matter how he tries to walk them back. Trump now says only the person who provides the abortion should be punished. Here at The World, we find it's helpful to push stories like this beyond U.S. borders. So in a few minutes, we'll look at abortion rights in Latin America. But first, we want to zoom in on one country there, El Salvador. That's where a 1999 constitutional amendment essentially placed a total ban on abortion. Paula Avila-Guillen is a lawyer and program specialist with the Center for Reproductive Rights. She joined us from El Salvador's capital, San Salvador. Avila-Guillen says El Salvador's abortion ban even punishes some women who've spontaneously miscarried.
Women who have miscarriages and they arrive to the hospital after the emergency, if they cannot prove that it was natural miscarriage, they are under suspicion of having had an abortion, and they risk prosecution by the government.
Wow. El Salvador's constitution, I know, was amended in 1999, placing a near-total ban on abortions. So since abortion has been criminalized, what's happened to women who try to terminate a pregnancy?
What is happening is there has been a spike on illegal abortion, and illegal abortion is one of the main maternal mortality causes in Latin America. So maternity mortality goes up when there is no access to legal and safe abortion. And then the other part was the most unexpected, but is the one that we have seen more dramatically and worried, is the women who have obstetric emergencies, from stillbirths to miscarriages, any type of obstetric emergency. And of course, these are women who live in rural areas and in poor situations, have been prosecuted for those obstetric emergencies, accused initially of having had an abortion, and then later on changed those charges to aggravate homicide, and then being sentenced up to 40 years in prison.
Well, I know there's one story, the 17-year-old Cristina Quintanilla, who received a 30-year sentence for infanticide. It's a complex case. We don't want to pass judgment on it, but can you just give us the broad contours of the case?
Yes, and the case of Cristina is a unique one. The majority of these cases are complex and are difficult, but they all share the same type of circumstances. A woman who is later on her pregnancy, in the case of Cristina, who wanted, she already had a son and she was happy to be expecting her second child. She is at home. She has an intense pain. And then she actually has a miscarriage. She doesn't understand what is going on and she passes out. Usually family calls the police because there is no an ambulance system, and call the police to help them get to the hospital. And when she gets to the hospital, they tell her that she had the suspicion of having had an abortion and that they need to call the prosecutor. They call the prosecutor and she goes from the hospital to the prison. During the whole process, she didn't even have proper representation. She didn't even understand what was happening. She didn't even completely comprehend why she will even need a lawyer. But she ended up being sentenced to 30 years in prison.
I mean, this case really seems to illustrate how a stillbirth or a spontaneous miscarriage could send a woman in El Salvador to jail for possibly decades.
Yes. And we have the case of Maria Teresa, who is sentenced to 40 years. And Maria Teresa didn't even know she was pregnant. And
yeah.
But what we have found out in all of these cases, we are litigating 17 cases at the national level and 9 at the international level, is the stigma that goes around abortion create this environment for women where they are guilty from the moment they arrive to the hospital.
Paula Avila-Guillen is a lawyer with the Center for Reproductive Rights. She joined me from San Salvador. Access to abortion is restricted in most of Latin America as well, and it's also not easy to find birth control in parts of the region. The World's Monica Campbell is usually based in Mexico City, but joins me today here in our Boston studio. How accessible is abortion throughout Latin America, Monica?
The short answer is not very. Legal abortions remain very rare in Latin America. In most countries, abortion is illegal, except in very rare cases. For example, in the case of rape or severe deformations, or if the woman's life is at risk. Then we have countries in Central America and the Caribbean, Haiti, Dominican Republic, most of Central America, Honduras, Nicaragua, and so on, where abortion is completely illegal. And the UN ranks those countries as among the most strict in the world when it comes to abortion.
I know there are some small bright spots, though. Colombia has decriminalized abortion in recent years. Where else have you seen some movement in Latin America on this?
Well, the boldest example is in Mexico City, which legalized abortion in 2007. But in other parts of the country, abortion is illegal. And I was recently on the border with Texas in the Mexico border city of Ciudad Juarez, and women there seek out alternatives to terminate their pregnancy. They look for a drug called misoprostol, which can end a pregnancy. It's actually used for ulcers, but you can go into a pharmacy or you can find it in the black market. I talked to one woman who used that, but this is the thing, is that they take these pills, they're not supervised, and a lot of these women can end up in the ER, but it is a safer way than some of the grimmer ways that women can seek out abortions in Latin America.
Kind of the back alley quacks and whatnot.
Well, the back alley abortions, I mean, I've been in some of the poorest parts of Mexico. I'm particularly remembering a young woman I met. She was 13. She was raped by her cousin in a very rural part of Mexico. And she sought out a woman who actually gave her a multi-day massage to try and massage the baby out. That's typical. Or herbs, you know, concoctions that can really hurt your organs that women will take.
So considering the strict laws, Monica, what can we say about how many women still die from illegal abortions across Latin America?
It's hard to put an exact number on it because we're talking about something that goes on underground. But thousands of women die every year because of abortion, illegal abortion-related health circumstances.
So, Monica, when we're talking access to safe legal services, what is the reality for most women trying to get an abortion in Latin America?
The reality is that a lot of it can depend on your income level. So some women can fly to parts of the United States and get an abortion. If you don't have that money, you will seek an abortion perhaps through a relative, a neighbor, someone who might help you access a drug like misoprostol. A lot of women, like that young girl that I met, will seek much more dangerous ways to end a pregnancy. I mean, one thing I've noticed, that, and this exists and it's existed for years in Latin America, is that there is an underground network of doctors, women and male doctors, who are sympathetic to women seeking abortions, who work and risk their own professional livelihood to provide abortions, safe abortions to women. And that's an underground network that a lot of people can't talk about openly because they're at risk of being criminalized themselves. But that is something that has existed for years in Latin America.
The World's Monica Campbell, good to have you here. Thank you for this.
Thank you.
Shifting gears now, let me take you back in time. 10 years ago this month, hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. marched to support undocumented immigrants and to oppose legislation targeting them. A decade later, we wanted to hear from some of the people who led those marches. We sent KCRW's Saul Gonzalez to speak with some of them.
It was Get Tough immigration legislation introduced by Wisconsin Republican Congressman James Sensenbrenner that sparked the protest marches of 10 years ago. Legislation that Sensenbrenner said was a necessary response to rampant illegal immigration.
Mr. Chairman, our nation has lost control of its borders. which has resulted in a sharp increase in illegal immigration.
The legislation, House Resolution 4437, mandated faster deportations and bigger fines for those employing people in the country illegally. Many interpreted the bill as also criminalizing people who even offered aid to the undocumented.
It not only cracked down and tried to demonize immigrants themselves, but anyone who helped.
Matt Barreto is a political science professor at UCLA who participated in the 2006 marches.
Anyone who even, you know, gave a ride or helped in any way an undocumented immigrant, just try to have a better life, was going to be in violation of federal law. So it was very extreme what it was trying to do.
So after the Sensenbrenner bill passed in the House of Representatives and awaited a Senate vote, Latino activists began to organize.
I said, we have to move.
Armando Navarro teaches ethnic studies at the University of California, Riverside, and helped organize against the Sensenbrenner bill.
The only political avenue that we had available to us was take to the politics of the streets, manifested by our numbers.
The largest protest was held in Los Angeles on March 25th of 2006, with 500,000 people marching in the streets of downtown. Protests followed in dozens of cities, including New York, Dallas, Seattle, and Milwaukee. And on May 1st, organizers increased pressure by staging a day without an immigrant demonstration, urging undocumented workers from nannies to janitors to cooks to march in the streets instead of showing up at their jobs. Again, Armando Navarro.
So we combined the power of the streets with the power of the pocketbook, meaning that we were going to organize so our economic power was felt, not only our political power of the streets, but our economic power of denying people profit and so forth.
Protesters claimed victory when the Sensenbrenner bill was defeated in the Senate. But since the 2006 marches, immigration advocates have debated the demonstration's legacy. Political scientist Matt Barreto says the marches allowed for initiatives like DACA, which lets undocumented people who were brought to the U.S. as kids stay here. He also says the 2006 protests created new leaders and political unity among Latinos.
It didn't matter if you were conservative. It didn't matter if you were U.S. born and third generation. Everyone could relate to what was happening. And that created this Latino identity that has since not left.
But Armando Navarro, who helped organize the 2006 marches, isn't as optimistic. He says that the defeat of the Sensenbrenner bill was quickly followed by more deportations and zero progress when it came to passing comprehensive immigration reform, including creating a path to citizenship for undocumented residents. Navarro blames some of this on activists who he believes didn't capitalize on the momentum of the 2006 marches.
And efforts were made during the latter part of 2006 to recapture that incredible energy, to recapture and revitalize it and move it forward now with the immigration reform as a focus. We didn't succeed.
Others argue that the 2006 marches created a lasting backlash against immigrants that's most recently found expression in the campaign rhetoric of Donald Trump.
Many of these gang members are illegal immigrants. They're rough dudes. They will be out of here so freaking fast.
Matt Barreto says if immigration rights activists want to revive the spirit of 2006 today, they need to do it at the ballot box and the streets.
You saw that as a theme in the rallies back in 06. There were a lot of signs that said, hoy marchamos, mañana votamos. Today we march, tomorrow we vote. So I would say that's the biggest objective now, is how do we take that energy that was there in 06 and turn it into very high rates of voter registration and voter turnout. Because when that tide turns, at that point, we'll have much more opportunity to send a message to politicians by voting.
We'll see if that happens this election year. For The World, I'm Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
Gold-plated sports cars are making some Londoners see red. Speed bumps ahead on The World. You may not know this, but a member of the U.S. men's national soccer team earns a bonus, even if the team loses. Now get this. That bonus for the men, for a loss, is four times bigger than what the U.S. women's team gets if it wins. That's according to figures in a federal complaint over pay discrimination filed by five players on the U.S. women's national soccer team. Remember, they won the Women's World Cup last summer in spectacular fashion. And do I need to remind you that U.S. men have never won their World Cup? For more on what's going on, we turn to Laura Armstrong. She's a sports reporter with the Toronto Star.
It seems ludicrous, especially when you look at the numbers side by side, as this sort of table that has come out today shows, especially given the Women's World Cup last year and that win and their victory tour. I think it needs to be reevaluated.
I mean, American women players are justifiably angry with this. That's why they're suing. But how do these numbers get justified?
I really don't know how they're going to justify this. I think that they'll go back and they'll say, you know, this agreement was made maybe in a time when the team was a little bit less popular, but even then they were still a popular team in terms of women's soccer. And I think these are really sort of black and white numbers, and that's probably going to help the women's team.
I mean, just, you know, an illustration with numbers, the women's national team gets $1,350 for a win in a friendly match, compared with $9,375 for men's victories in a friendly match. I mean, anecdotally, there are all sorts of excuses being given for why this is, right?
Right. Like, women's players are salary employed. I don't know specifically how much they make, but they'll make around $70,000, whereas a men's player, they only get paid by the federation if they're called into the team. Maybe they make the argument that the men's players have to work hard to get into the team, whereas the women's players are already paid by the federation. So maybe that's the argument. But it's so huge. And especially with the success of this team and these players, I think it's going to be very, very hard for the USSF to defend.
So this is the United States. These are American players. What about other countries like Canada or the Netherlands? How does this gender pay differential play out?
As a journalist from Canada, I find the most interesting aspect of this is what the implications are going to be for other countries in the world. Canadian soccer is sort of in the same situation as American soccer, where the women's team is just as well known, not even just as well known, better known than the men's team. It's going to be interesting to see what the implications are and whether there is a trickle down effect that could be a very good thing for women's sports or could be a bad thing for women's sports. It's going to depend on how this plays out. So I think that there are going to be a lot of other countries looking to the U.S. to see how they deal with this matter.
Should it matter how good the teams are? Shouldn't men's and women's salaries just be on the same scale?
Yeah, I think so. It was Hope Solo who said today, the men's team gets paid just to show up. We get paid to win major championships. I understand her argument and I understand why you would make that argument, but I think that it does sort of overlook the fact that at the basis of it all, the women's team should just be paid the same as the men's team.
So do you think this lawsuit is really going to change anything?
I think you have to hope so, but I don't know. I think that my main concern would be, what does this mean for Rio? I mean, you know, these players want to go to the Olympics. You know that they're favorited to, you know, stand atop the podium. But how far do you take it? It'll be really interesting to see how this plays out. Do they go to Rio? I don't know.
Laura Armstrong with the Toronto Star, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Last summer, the U.S. women's national team got $2 million for winning the World Cup. That sounds pretty good, right? Well, the German men's team got $35 million for their win. We've got a video up on our Facebook page all about that. Just look for PRI's The World. Speaking of millions, let's head to London and talk about supercars. It seems to happen every year around this time. Lamborghinis, Bentleys, Mercedes, the kind of rides you probably only heard about. They suddenly pop up in the most exclusive neighborhoods in London. But even by London standards, this spring seems special. Like rare birds, three supercars covered in gold have appeared on the streets. Londoners are talking, and it's not all good. Our man in London, Leo Hornack, doesn't have a license, but you tried to chase one down on a bicycle. Did you catch it, Leo?
Well, I got quite far. In fact, in heavy traffic, it's quite easy, I found, to out-pedal a bright purple Rolls Royce. That was one of the other cars I passed. No, I didn't actually see the three famous gold cars, but the fact is, in Knightsbridge, which is one of the most exclusive areas of London, where all these supercars kind of congregate, at this time of year, it's like a kind of weird Playboy rally. There are Rolls Royces, Corvettes, Bentleys, Porsches, Lamborghinis, everywhere you look. But as you said, perhaps none more eye-catching than these three supercars. They belong to a young Saudi billionaire called Turki bin Abdullah. And the ones that really caught people's eyes were a Bentley Flying Spur, a Lamborghini, a Rolls-Royce, and a Mercedes. It's all of these covered in gold, by the way. And the Mercedes also had six wheels, just in case it wasn't kind of noticeable enough.
What has been the reaction, especially when the cars are covered in this showy gold?
It's a very interesting reaction. It's this strange mix of envy and snobbery and snootiness and revulsion, all kind of tangled up. I mean, I saw one comment in the press. They had like comments underneath, you know, online.
Right.
And it just seemed to sum it up. This was from a Londoner. She said, "They're incredible. They're amazing. I mean, they're disgusting. You wouldn't want one." and as I say, that's the thing is, you know, it's tough times here. I mean, it's tough times in a lot of parts of the world. And people are really kind of squeaking by and just trying to make ends meet. And do you really need gold-plated Lamborghinis and Bentleys revving up and down the roads as you try and get home in the evening if you're a commuter? I mean, you can understand the hostility. But a lot of that hostility also gets turned into kind of sarcasm. I thought one of the best responses was once these three gold cars all parked and all the press was taking photos and it was going crazy on social media, a guy drove up in something called a Ford car. It's like a kind of European version of a Ford Pinto, I guess. And what he'd done is he'd got gold wrapping paper and covered the whole of his car in gold wrapping paper, this kind of cheap car, and parked it right next to them. And to be honest, you know, it didn't look that different, really. It really didn't look that different. And I imagine it was a bit cheaper to put together.
Yeah, you put it in our face, we're going to put it right back in your face. And this is a regular thing every spring, like the Swallows to Capistrano?
It's a season. There's a lot of young people with a lot of money from all around the world, particularly rich Gulf oil states. And this does become part of the backlash. There's a lot of, well, xenophobia, let's just say it. There's a lot of prejudice wrapped up in the response of local people here. You know, when you see a lot of the comments online saying not just that, you know, this car is flashy, but they're also saying, you know, a lot of real prejudice is wrapped up in the response of Londoners, I think.
Our man in London, Leo Hornack at the BBC. Thanks so much, man.
Thanks, Marco.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Philip Hoare has studied whales for years. Once he even swam right up to a sperm whale, and then the animal turned on him.
At which point I got very scared because I know that they are the only animal which could and indeed has swallowed a human being, and it's not a nice way to go.
That whale's tale coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A couple of stories out of South Africa coming up. First, big news involving the country's president, Jacob Zuma. South Africa's highest court has ruled that Zuma violated the Constitution by failing to repay millions of dollars in government money that he spent on his private home. Milton Nkosi is a news analyst with our friends at the BBC. He was in the courtroom in Johannesburg today when the verdict was issued. Remind us just how much public money President Zuma used on his private home and what he spent it on, Milton.
What happened here, Marco, is that the government decided to upgrade President Zuma's rural homestead in a place called Nkandla. And the government spent something to the tune of $23 million. Now, there has been controversial stories that a lot of the material, including a swimming pool, a chicken run, a cattle crawl, and an amphitheater, were not security features.
Yeah.
And those needed to be paid for personally by President Zuma, because President Zuma and the family unduly benefited from the security upgrade. Now, President Zuma, he has been refusing, saying that remedial action were mere recommendations. Well, today, the Constitutional Court said remedial actions were binding. Therefore, by refusing to pay some of the money, President Zuma was acting inconsistent with the Constitution.
Has there been any response from Zuma himself on this verdict?
Yes, indeed. He issued a statement and he said, I quote, "We noted and respect the judgment." And then he said that he would respond in due course, having studied the whole judgment. So we wait to see how he's going to handle this one.
How big a deal is this, Milton?
Marco, this is a big deal. The public in South Africa, by and large, are saying that President Zuma has abused his office and therefore he should pay back the money. But beyond that is that he should step down. The political parties, especially the opposition parties, are now saying that they are instituting impeachment proceedings against President Jacob Zuma.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how can President Zuma continue when there's this constitutional crisis?
It's going to be very hard for him to continue. The ANC, the governing party, which is led by President Zuma, now has the power to decide whether it recalls him. Now, it's not entirely clear if this is the route that the ANC will take.
I mean, President Zuma is already sitting under a dark cloud for, among other things, charges of nepotism and cronyism. Is there a sense almost of relief that this is now out there and we can kind of move to the next step?
This matter has gone from the lower courts all the way up to the apex court. And therefore, most people believe that finally there is a very clear violation of his oath of office, and therefore he cannot continue as president. But the complication here is that the Constitution, by law, has no provision to fire the president. So now the ball is in the court of the ANC, the party.
Finally, Milton, how did you read the reaction in the courtroom when the judge ordered President Zuma to pay back this money?
Well, there was a collective gasp of shock in the court. It was just an amazing sight to see that South Africa's democracy is alive and kicking when you see 11 constitutional court judges sitting there reading out a unanimous judgment. And many people I spoke to after the ruling, Marco, told me that they are happy that South Africa's democracy is alive and kicking, that the judges and the constitutional court are clearly independent, and that not everyone is a crony or a lackey.
My colleague at the BBC in Johannesburg, Milton Nkosi. Thank you as always, Milton.
Cheers, Marco. Always good to talk to you.
Zuma's troubles over the years have provided great material for one South African. He's the country's most famous political cartoonist. Goes by the pen name Zapiro, and his pen hits pretty hard. We put some of our favorite Zapiro cartoons up on our Tumblr. That's pritheworld.tumblr.com. Let's stay in South Africa for another story. In the apartheid era, millions of black and mixed-race South Africans were forced out of their homes. They were moved to barren land away from where the white minority lived. Now some families living in Cape Town are worried history is repeating itself, but this time under a democratically elected government. Sarah Birnbaum has our story.
Rose Salaji was one of the first people of color to move into her whites-only neighborhood in Cape Town.
I remember so clearly. The Minister of Housing at the time said that irrespective of color or creed, you shall not be refused a state house. That was a Wednesday. I couldn't wait for Thursday morning to come.
Thursday morning, Salaji woke up early and went down to the housing office to fill out an application. The staff looked at her like she was nuts.
And when the ladies will ask me now, you know you are a colored, why are you applying for a house here? So I said, who are you to tell me that I cannot rent from a state house when last night the announcement was made that anybody of color can apply? And that is exactly what I'm doing.
This was 1994, the year apartheid fell.
We voted for the first time, April. September, the 1st of September, I moved in here.
Here is in a place called Naruna Estates. Many of the houses, including Salaji's, are owned by the government and rented out to poor families at a very low rent. The neighborhood is orders of magnitude nicer than the township Salaji was herded into as a child. There are playgrounds and trees, train stations, schools, and supermarkets are close by. But now, Salaji and about 100 other families in Naruna Estates are at risk of being evicted. The government says it has to raise the rent. The families won't be homeless, though, says Provincial Housing Minister Bonga Kosi Madikizela.
Instead of chucking them out the streets, we are saying, look, given your circumstances that you can no longer afford to pay, we are going to give you an alternative accommodation.
That alternative accommodation is on the outskirts of the city, in the areas that black people had to live in before 1994. Madikizela says the government has no choice. Naruna is too expensive to keep up and people haven't been paying the rent.
If you can't pay, if you don't accept alternative accommodation, obviously the last resort is for you to vacate the property. I mean, that's how it is all over.
But what's different here is the government appears to be reverting to an apartheid-era legacy. When Cape Town was built, it was conceived as a whites-only city center surrounded by settlements for black laborers. To this day, most of the poor live in peripheral townships, while the wealthier white minority continues to live in the city center. Naruna Estates was one of the exceptions. Salaji admits she's behind on her rent. Still, for her, this feels like apartheid all over again.
As a person of color, you were removed from places to the outskirts. And in this day and age, they're doing it again. They're just doing it again on a different way.
Madikizela bristles at the comparison.
If you look at the people who are spreading these lies, are people who have failed to pay for years and for months. Now, in order for them not to be evicted, they are now coming up with this narrative and portray us as government as monster.
For now, Salaji is refusing to leave.
I just cannot.
She says the house itself is packed with memories. It symbolizes for her the end of apartheid and the beginning of freedom.
I just cannot just pack up and go.
For The World, Sarah Birnbaum, Cape Town, South Africa.
It's a pretty incredible sight, a whale breaching just offshore from where you're standing. And if a surprise whale sighting sounds fun, I can recommend Cape Cod right now. Scientists have spotted a pod of 80-plus North Atlantic right whales off the Cape. Pretty extraordinary when you realize there are only about 500 North Atlantic right whales in the entire world. The researchers got to see them from the air, but seeing them underwater is a completely different thing. Philip Hoare is a writer who spent years observing and writing about whales. So, Philip, what is that like, seeing a whale underwater?
It's extraordinary. And you're right, because, I mean, if you're lucky, it will breach, it will jump right out, and that's an astonishing sight. But it's an enigmatic animal because generally, you have to put together the creature in your head as a kind of jigsaw puzzle. When you go below the surface, what Herman Melville called the ocean skin, you suddenly see the enormity. I mean, it is like an iceberg. There's a kind of psychic disturbance in the water that happens when you are sharing that water with an animal like that.
What do you mean, psychic disturbance?
It's something that tugs at your soul. I'm sorry to sound spiritual about these animals. It's what they evoke in you, partly because of the shared history between us and them, which, if you're talking from a point of view of New England, it's a relationship of death up until very recently, and now it's a relationship of very fragile life. I mean, these whales, during the height of the whaling period in the 19th century, which Melville wrote in Moby Dick, they were lubricating the Industrial Revolution. They were lighting the streets of New York, Berlin, Paris, and Washington.
The whale blubber was a source of fat and energy.
Absolutely. And, you know, and the whaling industry was analogous to the mineral oil industry of our own day.
Incredible. So what is your assessment of these right whales appearing in great numbers off Cape Cod? I mean, it's great for the tourists. Is it a good thing for the whales that this is happening?
Well, you can watch them from the shore, from Herring Cove and Race Point. I've seen them, you know, off from Provincetown there, right off the shore, because they're coming quite close. But my friend jokes that they're like Hollywood superstars. They have an exclusion zone around them, even over the air. There's even an air exclusion zone around these animals because they are precious animals. You know, in the 1930s, they were reduced to maybe a few dozen. As you say, there's maybe up to 500 now. They are, fingers crossed, doing a lot better than they were. The problem with them is that they move across the ocean just basically like lawnmowers. sucking up the copepods, these tiny zooplankton that they eat. They're just bent on feeding. They have no notion of what might be approaching. And they are hit by ships. 50% of the whales in Cape Cod Bay have been hit by ships or entangled in fishing gear. They're incredibly fragile.
You've had a pretty close call with a whale. I don't know if you were one of those pieces of plankton, but I hear it's a near Jonah-like experience. Tell us what happened.
It was quite an extraordinary encounter, my first encounter with sperm whales, because I got in the water and the visibility was very reduced there in the mid-Atlantic. And so I was swimming towards these animals before I could actually see them. So I was only 20 feet away from them before I actually saw them. And suddenly it was like my vision was wall-to-wall whale, like a dozen whales. And unlike the blue whale, unlike the humpback fin whale, these are not baleen whales. These are toothed whales. They are the largest predator that ever lived. As I was watching, the largest of the whales detached itself from the pod and started swimming directly at me. At which point I got very scared because I know that they are the only animal which could and indeed has swallowed a human being, and it's not a nice way to go. So all this is going through my head as this whale is coming closer and closer and closer towards me, and I kind of think, okay, it's either going to ram into me with that huge, great, square, pugnacious head, or it's going to open its mouth at the last moment, you know. I felt its sonar moving through my body.
You felt that in your body? You could feel that?
I could feel it. It's a three-dimensional sound picture. It's like an MRI scan. I've been beamed back sonically to its head. And it was quite ironic because I'd spent years trying to describe a whale. Here was a whale trying to describe me. She came right alongside with this eye about the size of a grapefruit and looked directly at me. And it was the most extraordinary moment because it was absolute sentience there. She was reading me. She was trying to work out what I was, what I was doing in her world. I was clearly not a fish. I was not a seal. I was something else. And then she dove from this incredible intense blue down to the velvety black below and just vanished. It was just the most extraordinary encounter. It was almost dreamlike. So I think this female must have been perplexed. She'd never seen something like me before. I wasn't food. I was clearly something alien, but I was something like her as well. And ultimately, it's that connection, I think, that will be the saving of the whales because of our empathy for them. And that ultimately will be what saves them, I think.
Philip Hoare is the author of The Sea Inside. Philip, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
A note now before we take a quick break about prize-winning architect Zaha Hadid. She died today at the age of 65, an abrupt end to a wildly successful career. Hadid was born in Baghdad and then studied in Beirut in London, where she eventually started her own architectural firm. She designed sleek, modern buildings around the world, including the futuristic Swooping Aquatic Center for the 2012 London Olympics. In 2004, she became the first woman to win the Pritzker Prize, the so-called Nobel of Architecture. The prize jury praised her for her defiance of convention. It's a description that she agreed with, and we heard her say that, in essence, on, of all places, the BBC radio show Desert Island Discs. That's where host Kirsty Young asks guests which songs they'd want to have if they were marooned on a desert island. Here's Zaha Hadid after Young asked her about the architectural establishment.
I don't really feel I'm part of the establishment.
You still feel outside?
No, I'm not outside. I'm on the kind of edge. I'm dangling there.
In that interview, I also learned that Hadid's favorite movie of all time was Midnight Cowboy, and that Midnight Cowboy features one of her favorite songs of all time, Harry Nilsson's Everybody's Talking. Today, sadly, many people are talking about Zaha Hadid.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. The recent thaw in U.S.-Cuba relations could have a big impact on your health care, especially if the U.S. market is opened up to medicines developed on the island. One of them is called Cimavax. You'll hear more about it in just a minute. Cuba already sells medicines to many countries in Europe and Asia, but because of the U.S. embargo, these treatments are not available to American patients, at least not yet. Jose DeFabio is a vaccine researcher with the Pan American Health Organization. He recently stepped down as the organization's representative in Cuba. I asked him how Cuba, with all its economic problems over the years, was able to become a biotech powerhouse.
From the very beginning, the Cuban government has invested largely in human resources, and they have considered science, medical science particularly, as a responsibility that the country had to move into. And that's why they have developed a very large medical workforce. And usually when you compare, biotechnology outside Cuba, in the case of Cuba, salary was not a problem. So the resources were directed to build the infrastructure.
You're saying facility. Salaries are not a problem because people were getting so little money anyway?
Yes. For Cuba at the time, it was a reasonable salary. That's what everybody was making. But I imagine at that time, probably you were talking about $15 to $20. So if you have 1,000 employees, that was $20,000 that you have to add to your bill. If you have 1,000 employees in the United States or in Europe, you have to multiply by a larger number. Also, I think a major drive was the embargo. They had very limited the availability of medicines and biotechnological products. So the priority was to have the medicines required and also the vaccines they required and the biotechnological products.
So the lung cancer vaccine that was developed in Cuba, Cimavax, it's already been used on 5,000 patients worldwide. I know Governor Cuomo of New York signed an agreement to bring the company that's working on it to the U.S. Tell us about Cimavax and where we are in the research process.
Well, something interesting is that in Cuba, they have tried to tackle cancer in a different way. The concept is how we can control the cancer for not growing or expanding. So, how manage it so you can live with a cancer, as you can live with a chronic disease, but perhaps you will die of something different. And so they have involved then all this, the concept of trying to develop an immunological response to the cancer. If it's not able to destroy the cancer cells, at least it's able to keep it under control. And that's where the Cimavax vaccine comes.
How far away do you think we are in the U.S. from having Cimavax?
What I can say is that Cimavax has a lot of information on the clinical side. There are multi-center clinical trials undergoing, even in Europe. So I think there will be enough clinical data to support the registration of the product. Besides, probably they will request some clinical trial in the United States. So I don't see it should be a big problem to have that vaccine soon.
Assuming some laws change here, I expect, though, yes. All over the world, people are interested.
Yes, and of course, there is a market because the Cimavax, it started for lung cancer, but it's a vaccine that's directed against epidermal growth factor, a protein that is involved in growth of cells. So those cancers that are somehow related to this epidermal growth factor could be treated perhaps with Cimavax. So they are doing other clinical trials to see what other cancers could be product used for.
What are some of the other most promising medicines and vaccines that have been developed in Cuba?
They have also developed a very strong research and development on monoclonal antibodies, particularly directed to cancer. And they have even exported the technology to China. But they also have a very interesting product that's a treatment for diabetic foot ulcers. They have treated over 150,000 patients with diabetic foot, and amputations are avoided.
Are you able to say what the U.S. embargo on Cuba has meant to health for Americans here? Like, did the embargo delay life-saving medicines and therapies for Americans?
I think so, yes. Probably, all these innovative products that are there, they could have been used in the United States and also help Cuba, too.
Jose DeFabio is the former Cuba representative for the Pan American Health Organization. He spoke with me from Caracas. Jose, thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Finally today, from Cuba to Canada, Toronto's got Drake, The Weeknd, and now may have another rising musical star on its hands. His name is Jacoy. That's Jacoy's single, Odd Future, but it is his past That really interests me. Let's start with his name. It comes from his mom, a first-generation Canadian with roots in Jamaica. There's only one Jah, or God, she told him growing up. She also added, you're the real McCoy, so Jah Koy. It's a blend, but so is Jah Koy himself. His father is from Ethiopia. Jah Koy grew up in Toronto and found his way to poetry. Not intentionally, he says. He just heard beats and started reciting his poems over the top. Eventually, Jah Koy turned his room into what he calls his musical lab.
I look at it as more experiments. So when I go and do music, I look at it like I'm going into a lab right now, and I'm going to add chemicals together to get the best product. We don't know what we're doing. We're just trying because we know that, like, we know what we can do in certain ways, but we're stretching those boundaries to kind of get a little bit more of an extra pull and kind of, like, you know, stretching to, like, full potential in a sense. It's like, you know what? Sky's the limit when it comes to opportunities, you know? So it's like when you can try something, you never know what the outcome is going to be unless you get it done.
We caught up with Jah Koy recently at South by Southwest in Austin. The young MC is getting serious attention. Def Jam recently signed him, so a lot of people will be talking about Jah Koy soon. But he says his song Odd Future is something that came from a more personal place.
I wrote that record at home. And it's honestly a very personal record. I feel like at the time I was just kind of being more vulnerable and just like letting it all out and not being afraid of anybody having to have an opinion about how I felt. And so I was just kind of just letting it all out and just, you know, being vulnerable. Inside it kills, tell me how I feel when you really can't feel nothing. Stuck on my words, why does it hurt every time I say something? Sometimes it hits so hard you aim to be numb, but if it doesn't feel the same anymore.
Jah Koy with his track Odd Future brings things to a close today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.